Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In two separate incidents on Monday evening, two men were shot and killed in Columbus, bringing the city's homicide total to 48 at this point, a sharp increase over this time last year. Violent crime has been trending down for decades across the country, but in recent years, Columbus and other cities have seen contrasting spikes, especially with murders. U.S. City saw an 11% increase from the year before, according to Major Cities Chiefs Association. We're talking about the impacts of such violence, what it means, and how to turn that trend around. Joining us now is Columbus Division of Police Chief Kim Jacobs. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
Violent crime, as we said, is way down overall and over the decades. But this recent uptick must be a concern. What do you make of it?
Something that we have to try to really solve. What's going on and what the differences are between cities in different regions of the country. We know that Ohio suffers from a lot of drug addiction, and drugs drive a lot of crime, and people get pretty territorial about their area of delivery. So that's always one of our concerns. But just the violence, people reacting violently rather than with words and fists and things like that. Guns are being used in many, many situations where in the past people just argued or fought.
48 homicides, how many of them have involved guns so far?
39 or 38, I believe, of those 48. It's very significant.
Yeah, because I think there were about 29 homicides by this time last year. Now you have more than that involving guns alone.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have 38 with guns.
And you're saying you're speculating on a lot of it. Drugs? Do you know drugs are involved in a lot of it?
Well, we don't find the evidence of drugs necessarily at all of the scenes.
Okay.
What we find often is that there's a shooting and somebody calls and says there's somebody laying there bleeding. And so we don't get a call before that happens. We get a call after the shooting occurs. And generally, we find people behind a house, in the street, in an alley, and it's probably not necessarily wherever the altercation took place. We believe that sometimes people either run from the scene that this interaction happened, or they're placed there by the suspects. We also have a lot of our victims that are driven to hospitals by somebody that they were with. So finding the exact scene isn't always possible. So we're not necessarily finding drugs at those scenes, but we believe, based on the lack of cooperation and who is involved, that they might have been involved in drug dealing.
Are those just in general hard crimes to solve?
Certainly. The lack of cooperation that we get, sometimes even from not the homicide victim, because of course they can't talk, but people that might have been in the area are often afraid to tell us what they might know about those particular individuals, what they might have been up to. And there's a fear of retaliation. I understand that. And, I can't say that it's not going to affect them in some way if they do tell us. We try to keep things confidential. But in court and in discovery, things come out and people are sometimes identified. It's hard to testify without your information, your personal information becoming available.
And there's the idea of being able to face your accuser.
Absolutely.
Right. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about drugs nowadays, we often think about just, you know, we've learned a lot about the opioid crisis and how it's emerged in Ohio from the pill mills to the Mexican heroin
right.
dealers who were not necessarily violent per se. But what role perhaps do gangs play in all of this? And what do we mean by gangs, maybe first?
People that are organized in criminal behavior, whether that's violence, whether that's drug dealing, whether that's some other type of trafficking, perhaps, of humans, sex slavery. There's a lot of different organizations that engage in criminal behavior, but for different things.
Yeah.
Now we've got cybercrime that's, by gangs or groups of people. So there's a lot of different activity that gangs participate in. Some of them are far more violent than others. And certainly we know that we have some of those issues here in Columbus. We have two different units of officers that work mostly specifically on gang activity.
Is there any sense of randomness to this, or are you pretty convinced that there usually is a reason for it, retribution of some sort?
Certainly that does happen. When we know that a gang member has been killed, we anticipate that there's the potential for problems at even the funeral.
Okay.
And so we'll make sure that we understand who's arriving and who's being at the scene of the funeral and try to prevent any violence there. You know, some of our shootings, we know, especially those larger groups, involve members of what we believe are gangs.
And as far as gang violence goes, is it usually, I mean, there's a reason for it? It's not just the initiation type of thing we used to hear about, or what? Do we even know?
I think there's a variety. I don't think there's one thing. It can be initiation. It can be prove that you're willing to pull the trigger, but it also can be some type of retribution. You know, they dissed us, so we're going to go show them by the use of guns what we think of that.
The city's community safety initiative is set to extend to a year-round program. It might have already be underway. Can you explain what the initiative is, how it works, and why it's being expanded?
Well, this year we're making more tweaks over the 10-plus years that we've done this summer initiative. We have tried to continue to tweak it to address ongoing problems. This year we're involving our gang units to a much higher degree than we have in the last few years. The gang units used to be involved. This year we're going to have them be the coordinators. We have officers that work temporarily with the gang unit so that they can learn more about the identification of gang members, what their habits are, where they practice their you know, criminal behavior. And they're going to go out there and work with our patrol officers that are on special. You know, they've been taken off the streets to work with this particular initiative so that we have more officers looking for some of this violent behavior.
The city spent or allocated about $750,000 or $700,000 for this initiative for the year to expand it in this way. Is that mostly personnel on the streets?
It's to replace the people that are now working with this initiative.
Okay.
Because we still have calls for service to answer. So we fill in, do backfill for those officers that have been taken off the street. We do backfill with that. So it's overtime.
Okay.
And we do use it for some equipment as well, but mostly it's just for the backfill that we have with the officers that are on special.
Is the expansion of the Community Safety Initiative a response to this uptick in violent crime, or especially, or were you seeing some issues before this?
Well, certainly we believe that there is a slight uptick in some of the violent crime. So we're going to watch that throughout the year until we get a better handle on it. It's been focused on the summer just because we can't use $750,000 and stretch it necessarily all year long. But we do it during the summer because there's more going on. There's more people out on the street. There's more festivals. There's more events. There's more activity. And kids are out of school. So we know that people are more vulnerable in the summer. And there's a lot more people out and about that we want to protect.
Some community activists aren't impressed with the idea of the Community Safety Initiative. They say that battling the violence should begin with dealing with the relationships between the community and police. And you've already said that cooperation in the community in helping solve these crimes is a big problem. Can you talk about – but you said – I mean, obviously, you said that they're concerned about retaliation for cooperation, you know, ultimately not being able to stay under the radar. So what about but they're saying actually the community and the police need to work on their relationship more.
I totally agree. And I think that we've been doing that for many years. We attend 300 to 400 community events every single month with our personnel. And we are constantly out. Our community liaison officers attend a lot of meetings. Our patrol officers attend a lot of meetings. Our command staff also. One of the things that we're doing is trying to get officers to go talk to people, neighbors, so that if they talk to 100 people and they get information from one or two, that one or two won't be identified.
Yeah.
Because they'll be part of the
lost
big mix.
In the shuffle, right?
Exactly. So we can get information by establishing relationships. We've done a lot of dialogue sessions. We've done it with students. We've done it with the Boys and Girls Club just to ease some of the fears about talking to the police. And we hand out phone numbers and email addresses so that people can contact us and feel like that information can be used in a positive way.
What do you learn from the community? What can they tell you? Most people aren't witnesses to these crimes.
No, but I do believe that the neighbors know who's carrying guns, who might be involved in the drug dealing, who might be involved in the gangs. And once they feel comfortable enough in sharing that information, even though it might not be about a particular crime, they've told us who concerns them. And so that's somebody that we can pay attention to. Our community safety initiative is in particular paying attention to some of the people that we've had the most problems with and some of the locations that we've had the most problems with. And so we're going to focus our effort on violent crime this summer. In the past, we've kind of done whatever that area of town needed, mm-hmm. Whether it was thefts from autos in one place and burglaries in another. This will be much more focused on violent crime.
Others have criticized the safety initiative for targeting poor black neighborhoods, and Public Safety Director Ned Pettis told the Dispatch that this year it won't be used in specific neighborhoods. I'm wondering, how do you target resources in this?
Basically, like I just said, just towards the people that we know are engaged in violent crime or criminal activity, and towards the locations that we get a lot of calls for. Unfortunately, in our urban areas, we do get a lot of crime. People are not able to protect themselves. There's shootings going on at night. People can't necessarily go to sleep without hearing gunshots. Those people deserve to be able to go to bed without thinking a bullet's going to come whizzing through their walls.
Yeah, it was pretty dramatic call the other day from someone saying the kids are on the kitchen floor. They've just been eating dinner.
I can't stand that idea. People should be able to be secure in their homes, and that means that we have to make the streets safe. And that means looking for people that care less about others than they do about their turf or their beef or whatever it might be.
Tammy Fornia Alsada, she's an organizer with the People's Justice Project. She said that her group's been advocating for the city to treat gun violence as a public health epidemic. We've heard these kind of terms before. The city has had plans to hire an epidemiologist to study gun violence. Has anything come of that?
I don't know about the hiring of the epidemiologist, but certainly it is a public health issue in the sense that I can describe for you, domestic violence is one of the worst problems in our society, in my opinion, because people allow violence to occur in their home. And so children that grow up in those homes get used to this situation where violence is the norm rather than an aberration. And so if you've grown up with violence occurring around you,
in the most intimate circumstances.
Absolutely. And between people that supposedly care for each other and or have a relationship with each other, I believe that that's a public health issue because those children are not going to grow up with thoughts of, hope and happiness and a future. They're worried about day to day what's going to happen to them next. They might be the victim inside their home or at the school. They've seen violence on a regular basis. And so to me, that is a health issue because they're not going to have the kind of future that a lot of us have when we don't experience that in our home.
It's always kind of sad when you hear about a kid getting nailed for carrying a firearm into school. What took them to that level?
Correct. So, sometimes they see that bullying, whether it's in the home or among peers or just other groups. And, some of these gangs go after quite young children because they know the kids are not going to be punished like an adult. And so they'll get kids involved at a pretty early age. And if you've seen violence and know violence, then there's a lot better chance that you're going to pick up something to defend yourself or to use against each other. Bullying about whatever it might be, intimidating people, is something that criminals do often. And it's certainly something that bleeds over into our youth.
We're talking about the uptick in violent homicides. I guess all homicide is violent, but violent death in Columbus so already about 55% plus over what it was a year ago at this time. I'm talking with Kim Jacobs. She's chief of the Columbus Division of Police. If you have thoughts or concerns about this issue, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'd like to hear from the communities where this is a particular issue and know what you think. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out the All Sides Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the increased rate of homicide so far this year in Columbus. And one night earlier this week, two men were shot and killed in two separate incidents, bringing the homicide total to 48. That's a significant spike compared to this time last year. Still with us is Columbus Division of Police Chief Kim Jacobs. Joining us is Ohio State University Professor of History and Sociology and co-founder of the Historical Violence Database, Randolph Roth. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ann.
There is a social contagion, is the phrase that's used, associated with violent crimes. They stress out everyone, especially children and women, and women are at higher risk for premature births, which factors into Central Ohio's high infant mortality rate. Is violent crime also a predicate for more violent crime? Can it spiral up on its own accord? Randolph Roth?
Well, you know, certainly when you have things like civil wars or civil breakdown, it really does become a contagion. Whether we're looking at that right now is a question. There's a lot of imitation violence. There's always been imitation violence. Even in the 19th century, people would read things in the newspapers and do exactly what they saw somebody did in the newspaper.
Copycat
and even quote
crimes.
It. Absolutely. There's mm-hmm. copycat crimes. So we've had media-oriented copycat crimes as long as there's been media. In fact, it goes back to ballads sung in the 16th century, these popular ballads about crimes. People get ideas and they imitate it. So certainly there's a lot of – there's not a lot of – I hate to say it. There's not a lot of originality in murderers. They're pretty much – you know, a lot of them look just the same as the other. It's a lot more – you know, so I think contagion is part of it. But I, what we're seeing right now I think is something that has a cause.
What do we know about the perpetrators in these things? Do they tend to be young? Do they tend to be anything particular?
Sure,
Kim Jacobs.
Unfortunately, our victims are predominantly Black, and so are our suspects. It's about 70 to 75% on both our victims and our perpetrators, the suspects, mostly male. Victims and mostly male suspects as well for homicides. We have very few other nationalities or ethnic groups that are represented in our homicides. We are solving around 60% of those homicides, so we know there's a lot more suspects out there that we don't necessarily have identified.
How many gun incidents are there or shooting incidents are there that don't result in a homicide? Because we don't hear about those as much.
Well, we had, show you for 15.
2015?
Yep. Yeah. 2015, we had 1,615 aggravated assaults.
And which means there was a gun involved.
Some type of weapon. Yeah,
yeah,
generally it's going to be a gun. And then 1,484 in 16. But in non-fatal shootings, we had 325 in 15. Mm-hmm. And 339 non-fatal shootings in 2016. So mm-hmm. that's a lot of people being shot.
Right.
You know, more than 300 both of those years mm-hmm. that just because the bullet didn't kill them, mm-hmm. didn't die.
And didn't get as much attention.
Correct. Correct. But we do track those. And mm-hmm. We track the aggravated assaults. We track the rapes. And we track the robberies because those are the violent crimes where we know there's some type of a confrontation, you know, one-on-one generally or more than one on a victim perhaps as well. We have sometimes mm-hmm. multiple suspects involved in one homicide.
Jennifer in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I have a comment and then a couple of questions. I do take exception to Ms. Jacobs' characterization of domestic violence as allowing violence in the home. There are a lot of social implications for why domestic violence continues in a home, and that's probably another topic.
I guess
for
you're assuming
show.
That she's saying that the victim's allowing it, and I'm not sure I read it the same way, but go ahead, Jennifer.
Okay, so my main questions are, of these murders, how many of them occur as a result of domestic violence, and what kind of special programs are in place here in Columbus to address that problem?
You know, we were talking off the air, and I certainly want you to answer Jennifer's question and also get to the issue of the generational impact.
Absolutely. I feel very strongly about domestic violence, so much so that I go out and introduce the subject when we're training our recruits and introduce the instructors who are our domestic violence prosecutors. I'm on the board at the Center for Family Safety and Healing. Domestic violence is a scourge to our society. And no, I don't believe that anybody allows it. It occurs in the home, and it occurs on a frequent basis. Often people don't have a choice and don't have a way of escaping that. So in 2014, we began tracking this after I became chief. In 2012, we had just a few domestic violence or intimate partner-related homicides. But in 2014, we had 8. In 2015, we had 12. And last year, we had 17 that were related to domestic violence or intimate partner violence. And domestic violence can also be a relative. It can be a grandparent, a parent. It can be, you know, a sibling as well. Mm-hmm. But that's a lot of homicides that are related to violence that occurs in the home or in relationships with each other.
The people who supposedly care about each other and having children grow up in that.
Correct. So I'm very proud of what the division is doing about domestic violence. We have a dedicated unit for just domestic violence. We have a sergeant and 10 officers that are looking at domestic violence cases to see if it can be raised. It's a misdemeanor, generally, first occurrence, and depending on the injuries. If it's violent enough, if somebody's seriously injured, it becomes a felony. We have introduced in not just Columbus but in this region the lethality assessment program, which is based in Maryland but has spread across the country now or is spreading. We ask our victims of domestic violence a certain list of questions, and if they respond yes or no, we put them in direct contact with a counselor who can tell them the type of danger they're in immediately. They're on the phone while the officer is still present, and they can find out whether or not there are services available to the victim. If they want shelter, we make sure that we can provide them shelter. We now have a shelter that will accept everyone that needs shelter immediately, or we can give them, you know, information on how to access services that they might be able to do as well. Included in that lethality assessment program, we're now focusing on the dangers of strangulation. Strangulation is a very important clue as to how serious somebody is in their violent act against somebody else. So if that has occurred, we look even further into those particular cases with our detectives who try to explain how dangerous the situation is to the victim and how close that might be to the next step becoming a homicide. So as I said, I'm very proud of the work that we do with domestic violence. We are heavily engaged in that. We train our officers far above what the state requires for domestic violence training. And we have a great relationship with the prosecutor's office and very experienced domestic violence prosecutors in both municipal court and in common police court.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for that call. Randolph Roth, what's the significance of the method of violence?
Oh, you know, you can tell a lot about the nature of the crime from the wounds, the motive of the crime, and good detectives know that. And again, when you're looking at a domestic homicide, often the wounds are much more, I'd say, vicious, mm-hmm. much more personal. In other words, a lot more stabbings, a lot more beatings, a lot more. Even if it ends in a shooting, there is prior violence there. And so these things escalate. You can really see it in a lot of these cases. I mean, the police department in Columbus has been generous in letting me look at, you know, historic cases, you know, from the 80s and the 90s. Mm-hmm. And you can just see that the detectives find a pattern over time. They've been to the house many times. They've gotten actual prosecutions. And one of the things that is difficult from a prosecutor's point of view is to how, once you've identified it, you have intervened, how do you get it to stop? How do you get it to change? And, of course, one thing that I just was learning about is, you know, some of it has to be more compulsory training for the couple. In other words, forcing them essentially to go into therapy together under court order. And we don't have that strongly enough, where there are these programs now coming in and saying you need to mandatory counseling, talk about how you get angry, talk about other ways to resolve it. It sounds like sending people back to elementary school. Well, yeah, it is, in terms of the elements about how to relate to another human being. Another thing that's interesting, my student, Sarah Paxton, who's got a law degree as well as a She's working on her PhD. She's worked in a prosecutor's office, and she's trying to understand historically why women stay. What are the reasons why they stay psychologically, materially, how that's changed over time. And so the wounds will be different. For instance, if you go back to the 19th century, Protestant women left, so they were shot after they left. Catholic women stayed, immigrant women stayed, and they got beaten to death or knifed to death. And so you're seeing things about the culture, about the ability to leave, about and the thing is, leaving is not necessarily in that first year. Yeah. It is not the simple solution, as Chief Jacobs knows. You're more at risk the day you say, the instant you say, I'm leaving, is the time you're most at risk. That next few days, that next few weeks, that whole first year or two or three. And so you can see that when we talk about wounds, yes, if you leave, you're going to get shot. But you stay, it's going to be a different kind of wound. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And when I hear you talk about it, you do talk about it in terms of like almost a disease. There's an epidemiology to it.
Absolutely. There's a culture to it. And what you can see, for instance, is we are not at the level that we were in the 60s and 70s. And my students are working on this now. I'm working on this. The misogyny that you see in response to the feminist movement was stunning in the 60s and 70s. And we expected it to manifest itself in domestic violence. It's manifesting itself in nasty violence, rape murders, robbery murders, butchery of elderly women. I go in to rob them and I rape them, and just horrifying violence. And so the thing is when you see a surge like that, I think we're coming down from that. We see misogyny in this election rearing its ugly head, but we're not where we were in the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And it's because of the kinds of work that the police department is doing, social services are doing, prosecutors are doing, but also education is the key. And we have to get tougher in terms of saying one thing that's controversial is we need to get the guns out of the home if this person is under a court order. We just have to do that. Now, that's not a violation of their rights. They've broken the law.
And but the problem is with guns, Chief Jacobs, is that it's not like somebody reports they have a gun in the home.
They don't have to.
They don't. I mean,
they're readily available.
And they're illegally readily available.
It does help to get them out.
Yeah.
And so anything we can do to get them out, just for the two or three years, until the relationship gets better or it gets resolved peacefully one or two years after the separation. So this is not a permanent disarming of an individual. It's not a violation of their rights. It's to say that a gun in the home, particularly when someone is going to leave, I think is a very, very dangerous thing.
Absolutely.
Just switch gears here a little bit, going back to the Community Safety Initiative. Joining us on the air is Jasmine Ayers. She's running for city council in Columbus. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Anne. And I have to tell you, my mom is wants me to tell you that she loves you very much.
Okay. I love her back. Okay. Thank you, Jasmine. Go ahead.
So I just would like to address this circular thinking on an increase in violence in the summer needs to be met with more policing. If traditionally, throughout the last 10 years, there has been an increase in violence in the summertime and there has been the same response, to me that says that what we're doing is not working, right? And that increased police presence is not actually addressing the problem. And so I think that we know that creating good jobs, right, lowers crime, right? And a lot of our kids who are out in the summertime, right, like deal with a lot of trauma. A lot of these children have PTSD from living in neighborhoods where they have to eat on the floor and gunshots come through their windows.
Yeah.
And we need to address those things, again, from a public health perspective. We need to have trauma recovery centers in our neighborhoods, and we need to get away from this thinking that, oh, there's increased crime, we need more police. Well, if we've been doing that for years and years and years, it seems to me that we might want to be trying some things differently.
It's interesting, the using the word trauma recovery center. Chief Jacobs, what's your response to that?
I do believe that a lot of people suffer from trauma. We did trauma-informed policing training this year for our officers. so they better understand the trauma that they face, but also the trauma that our community members face. So we're educating our officers on how to deal with people that have faced trauma, been involved in trauma. It is very important that people understand the effect that it can have on them and the way that they view the world and how that drives their reactions and actions. So I don't disagree that type of education is important or type of service is important. I control what I control within the Division of Police and how we respond to calls and crime. But I do know that the city is actively working on many different areas to deal with kids being out of school, how we can help kids, keep them busy, keep them out of trouble, keep them in safe spaces. So it's a multi-pronged approach, in my opinion, that is very, very necessary.
Yeah,
I can speak to that. You know, the caller is absolutely right. There have been controlled studies that show when we employ young people at risk over the summer, their criminality goes down. Who's going to pay for it? We know that during the New Deal, the homicide rate went tremendously down. But there was a tremendous jobs program there, 3 million people, and they got training. They were learning how to be productive citizens. They got their GEDs. And we know that concentrated poverty is what's the killer. Once you control for concentrated poverty, all racial differences disappear. Cultural differences disappear. You know, we're looking at rural, concentrated rural and urban poverty here. And giving people hope, giving them an option, giving them something, a meaningful life, a meaningful work, really matters. And again, you know, the problem is that you know, our economy doesn't always do that. And I'm absolutely believe in free market and capitalism, but markets fail. They fail a lot of people.
And they tend to be the people at the bottom.
That's absolutely right. And they do very well for the people at the top. And so the question is, you know, we don't have the same political will we did during the Great Depression or that we had in the 50s. You know, I remember my grandparents, people who had little help, people who had even less. And we're not in that mentality right now. Mm. And I think that if we're going to come together as a nation, we have to realize that the science shows that public works helps, public jobs, meaningful jobs helps, summer jobs help. That's the key. And it's in America, it's the key to your self-respect is having meaningful work.
Jasmine Ayers, Columbus City Council candidate, thanks for calling in. I appreciate your time. Thanks to your mom for listening. I appreciate that as well. We're going to continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the increase in the number of homicides at this point in the year. Just this week, two men were shot and killed in separate incidents that brought the current total to 48 homicides, a roughly 55% increase over last year at this time. Still with us is Columbus Division of Police Chief Kim Jacobs and OSU Professor of History and Sociology and co-founder of the Historical Violence Database, Randolph Roth. If you have a question or comment, if you have thoughts about this, if you're from one of the communities that are particularly hard hit when it comes to violent crime, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Chief Jacobs, the city also is launching a voluntary civilian patrol with a pilot program in South Linden. How's that going? What are you shooting for there?
Well, I think it's people that care about their neighborhood that want to help make people feel safe and to report crime. You know, the city has supported the Community Crime Patrol for many years. Civilians that are paid to look out for crime and to escort people if they need it and to just keep a watch, you know, the old idea of the watch person. And so I think that this is community members who care deeply about their community and want to be part of the eyes and ears that can report crime and look out for people. And as long as it's safe and that they don't overstep and try to engage and you know, make an arrest or something
like that. Vigilante
type. Correct.
Yeah.
We don't need that. People don't recognize that type of authority. And so there's more chance that there could be a bad outcome. But I believe that the community does need to care about its neighborhoods and people need to care about their neighbors. And so as long as it's done with people that understand what they can and cannot do, I think it's a good thing.
Iris from North Linden called or has a question. She says, will patrol officers get any violence de-escalation training?
We already have. At least 2 years ago, we did de-escalation training. And it's not something that we do once and are done. All through our careers, we're taught about scenarios that we can deal with. And not all of them are deadly force scenarios. So quite often it's, this is what you're presented with, and what are you going to do to come out of that successfully? And sometimes successfully means your weapon never comes out of your holster, and sometimes that just means your communication skills. We do that even with people that are armed. We do that with situations that represent dealing with the mentally ill and how to talk to them. We have CIT-trained officers that are specially trained in dealing with crisis situations. But all of our officers have had de-escalation training recently and then throughout their careers. We do scenario-based training. We have rooms that are set up as a real-life living room or apartment or something like that and then go through the motions and then debrief it afterwards and say, this is an outcome that could have worked had you done different tactics. And so we're constantly trying to teach officers about good positioning, about communication skills, and trying to calm people down.
Molly in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I have a question for Chief Jacobs. You mentioned the CIT-trained officers, but we know that there's only a small minority of officers who are trained, and even those haven't been deployed properly.
What so do you mean by CIC?
CIT.
CIT, the trauma...
Crisis intervention train.
Gotcha, okay.
Right, the folks who are, you know, Jerron Thomas called 911, asked for help. In the middle of a mental health crisis, and police responded, and it resulted in his death. We know that the Summer Safety Initiative has had a really dark history of jump-out boys coming in neighborhoods and overly aggressively targeting low-income Black neighborhoods. And so I think some of the callers mentioned earlier that, you know, violence as a public health issue isn't just about mental or domestic violence in the home. It's actually about how violent outbreaks spread and how we actually get to the root of the cause. The public health approach actually requires us to go to the root. And the aggressive policing, when we've seen Tyree King, Ron Thomas, Kwame Patrick, Henry Green, all of these officers who've killed people in these communities, there's a huge fundamental lack of trust. You add on an additional 100,000 videos that were deleted right after an incident, people fundamentally don't trust the police. And so how are we actually supposed to expect that after 10 years of a failed jump out boy strategy with these summer safety initiatives, summer strike force, whatever its new iteration is called, it's producing the same results and it's not safer communities?
So Molly, you're saying sort of like this is the definition of insanity. We're doing the same thing over and over again. Is that what you're talking about?
And it's actually, yeah, and it's escalating violence rather than de-escalating it. If you're saying we already have these de-escalation programs in place, why aren't they working?
Chief Jacobs?
Well, I would urge you to learn more about how the division operates and what the actual plan calls for. Jump outs have not happened for a very, very long time. And even what was described.
And what is a jump out?
It's officers pulling up on a group of people, jumping out and trying to talk to them, search them or whatever.
Okay.
That does not occur. We don't do that. If it was done many, many, many years ago. And as I said before, we do tweak the plan. Doing the same thing is not always the best thing. And so we tweak it. As I said, we've done it this year so that we're focusing on the locations that we know are problem areas and the people that we know are problem carrying guns, creating violence. I would urge Molly to learn more about the division. We have a Citizen Police Academy that she could attend and find out a lot more about how we actually operate. When officers are defending their life, the United States Supreme Court says that they're allowed to do that. And under threat of a gun or being fired at, they are allowed to defend themselves. So I understand the idea that aggressive policing is out there, but I would urge more education, more information to be shared. We have a lot of opportunities for people to learn how we actually do our jobs.
Molly, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. What about body cams and police body cams and those kind of things? Does that really make a difference? I know that last October, Columbus City Council approved funding for more surveillance cameras in the city, the Far East Side and the Far North Side and Franklinton and that kind of a thing. How much does all that stuff help?
Well, Professor Roth might be able to discuss what the impact of cameras has had on crime. I believe that some crime is opportunity crime. When you know that there's a camera in the neighborhood, surveillance camera, neighborhood camera, a lot of businesses now have cameras. People don't commit crime because they're afraid of being caught. And so any type of camera system, whether it's cell phone, whether it's a body camera, whether it's a surveillance camera, I believe does have an impact on crime. Body cameras, I believe, are going to prove that officers do their job in a professional manner the great majority of the time. Every once in a while, it might catch somebody that reacted in a way that some people might say was poor. And then we'll have evidence to hold them accountable for that.
Unless it's lost.
Well, that was a totally different situation.
Okay.
That was cruiser video, and it was videos that we'd already downloaded, most of those that we needed. It's been represented as it was a technical failure, basically, a technology failure. But I don't believe that that's going to happen again. The city has invested in buying a backup system. We had a backup system. It just wasn't long enough, big enough. So I believe that the backup system will be in place to make sure that that kind of technical mistake doesn't happen again.
Sherry in Columbus on the east side. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Go ahead.
My question is related to the de-escalation training that you mentioned earlier, Chief Jacobs. When you have an officer who is shown to maybe repeatedly not de-escalate a situation, for example, Officer Rosen is under investigation. You know, it's been almost a month.
And the Henry Green shooting, yeah.
Right, but it's been almost a month since you mentioned he would be investigated for kicking the other young man in the head. When you have an officer like that, are extra steps taken to make sure that that officer understands that de-escalation training? Because, you know, it just seems like there are certain officers that may have a pattern of that behavior. What steps, what extra measures are taken in those cases?
So,
and what is the status of Officer Rosen's investigation?
Sherry, thank you.
So every officer's use of force is investigated, and then we file that so that we keep track of the number of times that the officers use force. We report even when the handcuffs have pinched somebody. We report any type of pulling somebody. We probably report more force than a lot of police agencies do. All of that's written down, and it's investigated depending on the severity of the use of force used. We file that, and then on every 6 months, we review to see if there's any patterns of behavior among officers to see if they're using any type of force that could have been prevented, you know, if they should have done something differently. And that's a group of peers who understand the circumstances that review that and then make recommendations to the chain of command. If they feel like there might be something to it, we investigate further. Even if it was cleared the first time, if we see a group of incidents, then we look at that. The investigation of Officer Rosen is over. We are now in an analysis stage to determine what type of discipline, if any, should be involved in that.
And how will people know when that's resolved?
We are putting out a media release, I believe, today that will describe where it stands.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Sherry, for that call. You know, I Randy Rotho, I want to give you a chance to chime in here if there's something that that you think requires more of a historical perspective and how we understand violence. It does seem like we're talking a lot about patterns of behavior. We're talking a lot about Absolutely. Pathology.
That's right. The thing is, if we're looking at what's happening now, we've had a long sustained drop in crime since really for old people over the age of 25, it's been dropping since the 1970s. For young people, they had this blip up and down in the late 80s, early 90s, but theirs has come down. So we've seen a reversal, a non-random, very significant reversal in 2015-16, and we're fearing it's 17 too. This is not taking us anywhere near back to where we were.
In the 90s?
Yeah. Certainly Cleveland has gone from 88 to 136 homicides from 2013 to 2016, but they were running 320 homicides a year back in the 70s. So we're not back there yet.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that, you know, what is going on? It's really we lost 1,900 more people in 2015 than 2014. That's a 12% increase. And what we're seeing is, you know, the heroin epidemic and the drug networks, we've been seeing them develop really for the last 10 years. But we just see this surge in homicide recently. We can talk about reductions in incarceration, but they've been very small. Mm-hmm. And we've been doing more with rehabilitation. So it doesn't seem that it's that. And some people hypothesize it was a Ferguson effect, that the police were withdrawing. And that's simply arrest rates have really been strong. Police are still doing their jobs. They're really trying to fight crime. And so we don't see that withdrawal. And you need strong policing. Wherever there's weak policing in the world, you see disaster. But what you're going to see here, and again, it's how people feel. It comes back to emotions. And one of the callers was right about this. The Columbus Police Department is damaged every time Chicago has a bad shooting.
Mm.
It is damaged every time Cleveland has a bad shooting. And what you can see is happening is the reverse of what happened in 2008-9. I thought in 2008-9, I said, if President Obama gets elected, candidate Obama gets elected, the homicide rate's going to drop like a rock in American cities right after the election because of what that says to young people about the future, about possibilities. And that year, the opinion polls, African Americans were more optimistic about the future than they were in a generation. And what you saw is the homicide rate rose where I thought it would, in the white supremacist areas, that spine from West Virginia, Alabama, over to Oklahoma. What we're watching is a reversal of that. We're watching a reversal of that trend. It turns out, yes. And so in other words, we've seen this spike in urban homicides, but not in the Hispanic cities. It's gone down in Miami, San Antonio, Fresno, El Paso. Even though the targeting, political targeting of Hispanic Americans is out there, they are immigrants are the least likely to commit homicide. It's native-born Americans that kill. And so what we're seeing is a concentration of this in cities with large African-American populations. We're seeing that this is hitting the African-American community. We're seeing that it happens, and the spike has coincided with these police shootings. But it's also coinciding with the end of the Obama administration and with the hard, with a different kind of feel that we're seeing. And you look at who's attorney general. People know the difference between Lynch and Sessions. Hmm. And so what you're seeing is a loss of legitimacy, a loss of trust that is really making your job harder, Chief Jacobs.
Randolph
Roth. That's what's going on, I think.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Professor of History and Sociology at OSU, co-founder and co-director of the Historical Violence Database. Thank you so much. And also Columbus Police Chief Kim Jacobs. Thanks for joining us today.
Certainly.
I really appreciate your
Thank
time.
You.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for your calls. Thanks for your emails. Appreciate it. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.